You are listening to a recording made available by the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry, Incorporated, as a service to God's people. This is message number 3 of 12 on the Book of Daniel by Dr. Reynold Showers. This message is entitled, God's Sovereign Rule Over the Gentile Punishment.
In order to understand properly some of the things that transpired in Daniel chapter 3, we have to take a very brief look at some of the concluding matters at the end of Daniel chapter 2. In our second session, we noted how God ministered in a very special way through Daniel by revealing to Daniel the content of King Nebuchadnezzar's dream and also the interpretation of that dream. And because Daniel was able to do what the king had demanded, whereas all of the other wise men of King Nebuchadnezzar had failed, we find in chapter 2, verses 46 through 49, that King Nebuchadnezzar reacted in a twofold way. Number one, Nebuchadnezzar was greatly impressed by Daniel's God. Now keep in mind, Nebuchadnezzar is a pagan man who prior to this had no special regard for Jehovah, the true and the living God. He was a polytheist. He worshipped many false pagan gods. But notice what he says to Daniel in verse 47, "Surely your God is a God of gods, and a Lord of kings, and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery." Now, he's still a pagan man. Notice he's not saying that Daniel's God is the only God. But he is tremendously impressed with Daniel's God. And he is recognizing that Daniel's God is superior to the other gods. For he says he is a God of gods, the God over other gods. So this pagan man is beginning to make some spiritual progress in his attitude toward the true and the living God. But Nebuchadnezzar's second reaction, verses 48 and 49 of chapter 2, was to promote Daniel and his friends. He made Daniel the ruler of the whole province of Babylon. Now you must keep in mind that the Babylonian Empire, being as massive as it was subdivided into various provinces. And Nebuchadnezzar appointed a governor over each province. One of the provinces in the Babylonian Empire was called the province of Babylon. It was that particular province in which the capital city of Babylon was located. So Nebuchadnezzar rewards Daniel by appointing him to be the governor of the province that contained the capital city of the entire empire, but also note, please, at the end of verse 48, that Nebuchadnezzar appointed Daniel to be the chief ruler over all the wise men of Babylon. When we look at verse 49, we find that although Daniel is being greatly honored, he doesn't forget his friends, and that's a good insight into the character of this man. And he puts in a special request to Nebuchadnezzar that Nebuchadnezzar honor his three friends as well. And Nebuchadnezzar does that, and it would appear that although Daniel was given the position of governor and head over the wise men, that actually Nebuchadnezzar gave to Daniel's friends the actual responsibility of fulfilling the rule of the province of Babylon and of ruling over the wise men. Daniel evidently was given the honored position and title, but his friends were given the responsibility of carrying out the responsibilities that would go with that position and title, so that this would free Daniel to actually be in other areas of service for the king. I think what is important to note here, by way of background for what takes place in chapter 3, is that here are foreigners, Jewish men who have been captured and conquered by the Babylonians, being put in positions of authority over the elite intellects, the Chaldeans, the wise men of the land of Babylon. And you can count on it, that did not sit too well with those Babylonians who were native to that empire and who had been in the position of power up to this point. To have conquered foreigners put in positions of authority over them would irritate them. On top of that, remember, Daniel and his three companions had been the students of these men. So here are former students being put in positions of authority over their former teachers. That, again, would not sit very well with these men. No doubt, over the next several days, weeks, and months, those men chafed under that change that had transpired and were waiting for an opportune moment when they could level accusations against these Jews who had been put in authority over them to try to rid themselves of the rule of these men over them. And one of those opportunities was going to come in the event that is recorded for us in Daniel chapter 3. Now in chapter 2, as we noted in our last session, we have the sovereign rule of God over Gentile empires demonstrated. But when we come to Daniel chapter 3, we have the sovereign rule of God over Gentile punishment demonstrated. And this is the whole thrust of chapter 3, as God overrules a unique form of Gentile punishment upon some of his Hebrew servants. The first section of chapter 3 is contained in verses 1 through 7, and we could entitle that Nebuchadnezzar's image. Daniel says, verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits, and its width 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. A royal cubit in the ancient kingdom of Babylon equaled 20 6/10 inches. In light of that, then, this particular image that King Nebuchadnezzar had erected was approximately 103 feet tall and approximately 10 feet 3 inches in width. Now, that seems to be greatly out of proportion, but probably a good part of the height consisted of a large base upon which this great image was placed. Note, please, that Nebuchadnezzar had this set up on the plain of Dura. A number of decades ago, an archaeologist by the name of Oppert went to the plain of Dura, which is approximately 12 miles southeast of the ruins of the ancient city of Babylon. And this archaeologist discovered several large mounds, man-made mounds, out there on the plain of Dura. One of these mounds was made totally out of brick. It was approximately 20 feet high, 45 feet long, and 45 feet wide. Very large mound indeed. And archaeologist Oppert came to the conclusion that this particular mound had the appearance of being the pedestal or the base of a large image or a large statue. And he concluded that it may very well have been the very pedestal for the particular image that is being referred to here in Daniel chapter 3. Note, please, Nebuchadnezzar is making a huge image. Where do you suppose he got the idea for a large image? I'm convinced from the dream that God had given to him, as recorded for us in the preceding chapter, chapter 2. But notice also, if you would, that Nebuchadnezzar had this image made entirely out of gold. Now, most are convinced that the whole purpose of Nebuchadnezzar erecting this image was to represent his great kingdom of Babylon. Why do you suppose he would have this image made entirely out of gold, representing his great kingdom of Babylon? Or you will recall that in the image that he received in, or that he saw in the dream that he had received from God in chapter 2, just the head of that image was made out of gold, and that golden head represented his Babylonian kingdom. But here is Nebuchadnezzar, as erecting a great image to the whole image to represent his kingdom, he decides to make the entire image, not just the head, but the whole image, completely out of gold. Why do you suppose he did that? I personally am convinced that this was his way of saying, I refuse to accept the idea that my kingdom will last only during part of Gentile world dominion, as my dream indicated. I am convinced that my Babylonian empire is so great and so powerful that it will endure forever throughout the whole course of Gentile world power here on planet Earth. And I refuse to accept what Daniel's God has said, that my kingdom will fall to a second kingdom, which in turn will be succeeded by a third kingdom, which in turn would be succeeded by a fourth Gentile kingdom. I erect an image representing my kingdom, but I make it entirely out of gold as my way of saying, my kingdom will never fall to another Gentile world empire. There was pride on Nebuchadnezzar's part in erecting this image. When it was time to have the day of dedication of this great image, Nebuchadnezzar commanded all the rulers of the empire to be present before this image on the plain of Dura. He brought them there for the day of dedication, and he gave a command that on that particular day, at a certain time when the musical instruments would give a particular signal, all of the officials, everyone who was there, were to bow down before that image and to worship it. Anyone who refused to worship the image would be regarded as a traitor to the empire, since the image represented the empire. And again, in order to give an added incentive for everyone to obey the king's command and bow down and worship the image, the command from the king indicated that anyone who refused to fall down and worship that image would be taken in the same hour, according to verse 6, and would be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. A raging inferno would be blazing inside that furnace. The idea being this would cause instant death, no escape from this punishment for those who refused to worship this pagan image. Ancient historical records indicate that one of the favorite forms of both the ancient Assyrian and Babylonian kings punishing rebellious subjects was to burn them alive in furnaces. And so this fits with what ancient history tells us about the Assyrian and Babylonian kings. Now, when you read on through the rest of chapter 3, you will find that Daniel's three friends were present in front of this image on the day of dedication. Daniel himself was not. We do not know why. The Bible doesn't tell us why. It may very well be that King Nebuchadnezzar had Daniel somewhere else in the empire carrying on royal business on this day of dedication. But his three Jewish companions were there. And once again, just as in chapter 1, these Jews were confronted with a difficult decision to make. On the one hand, here was the king's command. You bow down to this image and worship it as a god. And if you don't, you go into the fiery furnace. You die instantly. God, the one who had ordained human government, commands his people in the scriptures that they are to obey every ordinance of man. Here's an ordinance of man. However, there's a problem. Because God himself, who is superior to human rulers, had also given an absolute command to the people of Israel. In fact, two absolute commands. Number one, you shall have no other gods before me. And secondly, you shall not make unto yourselves graven images and bow down before them to worship them as gods. Here was a conflict between two authorities, both of whom God had ordained, the human authority and God himself. But the human authority that had been given its power by God was abusing that power and commanding something that was in direct violation of what the highest authority, God himself, had commanded. These Jews are on the spot. They're hung on the horns of a dilemma. When the two authorities that are over you disagree with each other, obviously it's impossible to obey both of them. If you obey the one, you thereby disobey the other. What were they to do? They had to make a decision. They made a decision, and by the grace of God, they made the right decision. When one authority commands something that is directly opposed to the higher authority, namely God, God's people must always obey the higher authority, God, even though that will cause them to disobey the lesser authority that is over them. So here they are. They're only given a few moments after that command until the signal is to be given by the musical instruments, and they've got to make a decision, and they don't have much time to make it, but they do make it. And after a while, the signal is given by the musical instruments, and according to verse 7, all the other people who were there, all the pagan people, bowed down to the ground in front of that image and worshiped. But we learn from the rest of the chapter that Daniel's three friends refused to bow and refused to worship. You talk about sticking out like sore thumbs. Here is everyone else prostrate on the ground. And here are three men who are standing completely erect. It was obvious who refused to bow. And evidently, some of the Chaldeans, some of the wise men who were jealous of Daniel and his companions, when they bowed, by this time learning what to them seemed to be some of the peculiar views of these Jews, peeked with their eyes open to see what Daniel's three friends would do. And they noted that these three Hebrew young men refused to bow before that pagan image. So that brings us to the second division of chapter 3, and this we could entitle Daniel's Friends Accused, and this is contained in verses 8 through 12. We read, "For this reason, at that time certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. They responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, 'O king, live forever. You yourself, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, is to fall down and worship the golden image. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up.'" These Chaldeans, again being jealous of Daniel and his companions, now have their opportunity. They've caught these men of whom they are jealous in an act of disobedience to an outright command of the king, and I would surmise they are so excited about getting in before the king that they probably almost climb over each other to be the first one to get in there to squeal against Daniel's companions. And the way they present their accusation, it seems obvious they are trying to put the Jews in the worst possible light. In essence, they said, "Here are these people whom you conquered, and you dealt with very graciously. You took these conquered Jews, and you honored them and elevated them into high positions of authority within your realm, But look at the bunch of ingrates that they are. Look at how they've responded to the gracious way you've honored them. They absolutely refuse to obey your command and bow down and worship your image. They are guilty of treason. They're showing contempt against you and against your great kingdom of Babylon. The accusation leveled against Daniel's three friends. This brings us to the third section of chapter 3, which is contained in verses 13 through 18, which we could entitle Daniel's Three Friends Tried. Verse 13 says, "Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these men were brought before the king." When Nebuchadnezzar learned what these conquered Jews had refused to do, he flew into a fit of rage. What audacity on the part of these foreigners to withstand the very ruler who not only had conquered them, but had honored them by elevating them to great positions of authority. And so immediately he commands for these three Jewish young men to be brought in before him to be put on trial. To Nebuchadnezzar's credit, according to verse 14, he gave Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego opportunity to tell their side of the story. He asked them a question, verse 14, "Is it true that you do not serve any gods or worship or serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up?" He's giving them opportunity to deny the charge, the accusation. But they don't deny the charge. So then again, to his credit, evidently trying to be somewhat gracious to them, he says, "I'll give you another chance." Perhaps he's thinking maybe they didn't hear the command straight, or they misunderstood, and that's why they didn't bow down. So he says to them, verse 15, "Now if you are ready, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, very well." He said, "Look, we'll take you back out in front of the image. We'll have the signal given again by the musical instruments. We'll give you another chance. And if this time you bow down and worship the image, great, no problem. But," middle of verse 15, "if you will not worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire." And notice this next statement. Here is the whole key to chapter 3 and what it is about. "And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands?" In essence, he's saying, we're going to make that fire so intense that there's not even any God around anywhere who will be able to deliver you from this form of Gentile punishment. Now, God does not have physical ears such as you and I have, because God does not have a physical body such as we have. But if God were to have ears, I'm sure his ears would have perked up in heaven immediately when he heard that statement. There's no God around anywhere who will be able to deliver you out of my hand. What a fantastic opportunity for God to demonstrate his sovereignty, that he is sovereign even over Gentile punishment. The stage is being set without Nebuchadnezzar recognizing it, for God to give a tremendous demonstration of his power and his sovereign rule. When we come to verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego responded to the king and said, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this." Now, some of our translations seem to give the impression that these three Hebrew young men were being rather smart-alecky with the king, and in essence saying to him, "We don't have to answer to you at all." But the original language would indicate that they are not being smart alecks. In essence, what they were saying to King Nebuchadnezzar is, "We've got no defense to offer. We did not bow down to the image. And it's not because we didn't hear the command right or that we misunderstood it, what it was given. We just didn't bow down. We've got no answer, no defense to make to you. We just didn't bow down. That's all. And they recognized that any defense they would have given to justify their actions, King Nebuchadnezzar would not have understood. So they don't even try to defend their actions. But they go on in verse 17 and they say, if it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. What implicit faith. They said, we're going to cast ourselves totally upon our God on this occasion. We are convinced that he will deliver us from your punishment. We know he's able to do so. But even if God in his sovereignty on this occasion decides not to deliver us, then so be it. We're going to obey him anyhow and take the consequences. We still will refuse to bow down to your image. Here they go again, out on a limb of faith, together with God, just as they did back in chapter 1. And the consequences are very obvious because there's the furnace over to the side with the fire already raging in it. What implicit faith. And what an example for God's people today. We are to obey God in his clear-cut commands and instruction to us, no matter what the consequences. And if God sees fit to allow us in tight situations, where when we decide to obey God, that makes things more difficult for us, then so be it. If God decides to deliver us out of that tight situation as we obey him, then praise the Lord. But if God in his sovereignty decides it suits his purposes better not to deliver us out of that terrible trial, then praise the Lord again. We are to serve him no matter what and obey him no matter what the consequences, and allow him as our sovereign Lord to take care of the consequences as he sees fit for his honor and for his glory. This was the attitude of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they are standing in the right way in complete obedience to God. The trial is over. They're guilty by their own admission. And so this brings us to the next section of chapter 3, and we could entitle that Daniel's friend's sentence. This is contained in verses 19 and 20. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath, and his facial expression was altered toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Nebuchadnezzar was so overcome by his anger and his hatred for these men who had the audacity to withstand the most powerful ruler on the face of the earth, that his emotions got hold of him and it distorted his face. He couldn't hide his wrath and his anger. His face went into a distorted expression. It's very obvious that he was hopping mad at these men. And in his rage, he answered their confession of guilt by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more intense than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain valiant warriors who were in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego in order to cast them into the furnace of blazing fire. Notice, he's taking special measures to make sure that these young upstarts will not be able to escape his punishment in any way, shape, or form. The fire is to be heated 7 times more intense than it was normally heated. And he assigns the strongest, the bravest of the soldiers in his Babylonian army to see to it that the execution is brought upon these men. And he has them bound hand and foot, so there's no way they can run away to escape this punishment. He's guaranteeing that this punishment will succeed against these 3 Jewish young men. And that brings us to the next section of chapter 3, which we could entitle Daniel's Friends Punished. Chapter 3, verses 21 through 23. Then these men were tied up in their trousers, their coats, their caps, and their other clothes, and were cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. For this reason, because the king's command was urgent, and the furnace had been made extremely hot, the flame of the fire slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. Now, Daniel emphasizes several things here about the punishment being administered to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to be able to emphasize the great miracle that God was about to perform. For one thing, please note, these three Hebrew young men were thrown into the fiery furnace with flammable clothing still on their bodies. Normally, clothing would ignite faster than human flesh and begin the horrible agony. So they're thrown into the fiery furnace with flammable clothing still on their bodies. In addition, the fire was indeed so intense, so hot, that after the strong Babylonian soldiers had cast in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, there was such an intense blast of heat and fire that came raging out of the opening of this furnace that it killed those strong soldiers. The emphasis here being upon the intensity of that fire. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not escape because the fire was very small or very mild. It was extremely intense to the point that it killed the strongest soldiers of the Babylonian army when they cast in these three Hebrew young men. In addition, please note, they were tied hand and foot so that when they were put into the fiery furnace, they fell. Now let me explain a little bit of what the furnaces were like in Babylon at this time. Archaeologists have uncovered some of the ancient furnaces of the Babylonian Empire. These furnaces had an opening at the top through which things that were to be burned were dropped into the fire. And there was an inclined plane that would rise from the level of the ground to the top of the furnace. And the men who were responsible for dropping the flammable objects into the furnace would climb that inclined plane and they would drop the objects through the top opening. And it would be a fair distance to be dropped from that opening down to the ground level of the furnace, so that when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego fell down to the bottom of that furnace, having their hands and their feet bound, they would lose their balance and they fell over inside the furnace. They weren't able, in other words, to get up and run out as soon as they were dropped into the furnace. These furnaces also had an opening on the side at the ground level through which, after the fires were completed, the ashes could be withdrawn and the furnace cleaned out. And we learn later on that Nebuchadnezzar had set up his portable throne that he took with him out on public occasions like this, opposite that side door, so that he could sit on his throne and enjoy watching this punishment administered to these upstart young men. He wanted to observe what was going on. But they were thrown in with flammable clothing. The fire was so intense it killed the soldiers when they dropped the three men into the fiery furnace. They were tied so well that they fell over when they hit the ground floor of the furnace. They were not able to get up and run out. All these things make it pretty obvious that under normal circumstances, in no way would Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego have been able to escape the devastation of this Gentile punishment. But that brings us to the next section of chapter 3, which we could entitle Daniel's Friends Delivered, and this is contained in verses 24 through 27. Nebuchadnezzar, who had been seated on his portable throne, looking inside that furnace, to see to it personally that the punishment would indeed be executed as he desired, saw five things that astounded him. In fact, he is so astounded as he observed what was going on in that furnace that he actually jumped up from his portable throne in a hurry. And he turned to the other Babylonian officials and in essence said to them, "Are my eyes playing tricks on me? Or am I actually seeing what's going on there? You tell me what you see going on in that furnace." And again, there were five things that astounded him. The first thing was this. Whereas three men had been thrown into that furnace, there were now four men inside that furnace. He was astounded. Where did that fourth person come from? The second thing that astounded him was that all four men were loose. Three of them had been thrown in bound hand and foot, but they're no longer bound. Why? What had caused them to be loosed from their binderies? The third thing that astounded him was that all four men were standing up and walking around in the midst of the fire. They weren't even indicating they were trying to get out. They were just in there, they were standing there, and they were walking around in the midst of the fire. That astounded him. The fourth thing that astounded him was the fact that none of those men in that fiery furnace were being harmed. What a contrast. Just one blast out of the top of the furnace had killed his most powerful soldiers. But the ones who are actually in the fire and staying in there are not being harmed whatsoever. And the fifth thing that astounded him, end of verse 25, is that the fourth person, the one who had not been thrown in there, had the appearance of, and let me give you a literal translation, had the appearance of a son of the gods. He says, "Look, I see four men loose and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." Now remember, he's a pagan man. And he's given a pagan expression. According to the Babylonian religious system, the Babylonians believed that their gods and goddesses cohabited with each other and thereby gave birth to sons. And those sons, being parented by deity, themselves were deity, were divine. And so, to say this fourth person looks like a son of the gods, this was his pagan way of saying that fourth person in there is a divine being. Is deity, has the appearance of a divine being. And we are convinced that he was right. Scholars, for centuries since this has happened, at least Christian scholars, have been convinced that that fourth person in the fiery furnace was none other than Jesus Christ in one of his pre-incarnate appearances. Come into that fiery furnace to deliver from Gentile punishment, these three Hebrew young men who had been faithful to Jehovah, the true and the living God. Nebuchadnezzar responded to this, obvious now to him that the God of Israel had overruled his Gentile punishment, that he was convinced there was no God who could overrule it, and recognizing it was useless to keep Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego in that furnace anymore, since he'd been overruled by Jehovah, he calls in through the side door of that furnace, and he commands Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to come out of the furnace and stand in front of him. Notice what he calls Jehovah. "And even them, you servants of the Most High God," verse 26. He's commending Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego for being faithful servants to their God. But notice what he's calling their God, the Most High God. Before he had conquered Israel and had started to have this personal involvement with the God of Israel, he had been convinced that Marduk, the chief god of Babylon, was the Most High God. But now that he's had some confrontations with Jehovah, and Jehovah's men who are remaining faithful to God, he's had to change his mind. Again, he's making some spiritual progress as a pagan. He now recognizes that it is the God of Israel who is the Most High God. Now please note, he's still not saying he's the only God. But he is recognizing that Jehovah is the superior God, even superior to all of his Babylonian gods and goddesses. According to verse 27, there was a whole group of eyewitnesses of this miracle. Here were all the other officials of the empire, the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's high officials gathered around and saw in regard to these men. So that this was a miracle that took place not in a hidden corner. But here were literally thousands of officials of the Babylonian Empire who were there and witnesses with their eyes, and therefore could give testimony as eyewitnesses of this miracle that Jehovah, the God of Israel, just performed. And again, there are several things that astound them, according to verse 27. Number one, the fire had absolutely no effect on the bodies of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. No blisters on their bodies at all. No scorched area of their skin. No effect on their bodies. Second amazing thing, the hair on their head wasn't even singed, even though they'd been walking around in the midst of that intense fire. Third amazing thing was that their clothing was not damaged. No scorching of the clothing whatsoever. And the fourth amazing thing was they didn't even have the smell of smoke on their persons whatsoever. Four things that emphasize the tremendous miracle that God had performed on behalf of these faithful Hebrew children. And this brings us to the last section of chapter 3, contained in verses 28 through 30, which we can entitle Nebuchadnezzar's response. And this is a tremendous response. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, who has sent his angel." Now let me point something out here. Remember, this part of the book is being written in the Aramaic language. In the Aramaic language, the word for angel was also the word for God, for deity. So in essence, he's saying again, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, who has sent a person of divinity or deity and delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God." And notice amazingly what this pagan king does. "Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses reduced to public bathrooms." Literally is what it says. "Inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way." Again, this pagan man, having been confronted in a head-on collision with the God of Israel, is tremendously impressed. So much impressed that he decrees that anybody within his realm who dares to say anything offensive against Jehovah, the God of Israel, is to have the death penalty inflicted upon him. Now, what can we learn very hurriedly from this? I think several things. One is, what does a believer, a child of God, do when there is a conflict between what his government commands and what God commands? Especially in light of the fact that believers are commanded to obey human government, since human government is ordained of God. We have to keep in mind that although human government is ordained of God, governmental authorities can sometimes abuse that God-granted power and authority and use it in ways contrary to what God designed and ordained. Whenever the people of God find themselves in a situation of life where there is a direct conflict between what human government commands and what God has clearly commanded of his people, it is the responsibility of God's people in a situation such as that always to obey the higher authority, to obey God. But it's also their responsibility, as they obey God and thereby in some instances have to disobey the government authority, it is also their responsibility to take the consequences of disobeying that government authority without starting a riot or without trying to overthrow the government. Verse 30 makes it very obvious that even though this government of Babylon had abused its God-ordained power, when God delivered Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego from that Gentile punishment, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego did not start a revolt against this king because of the way he had abused his power. They continued on serving him as loyal subjects. As the people of God, we must obey God no matter what the consequences, even when that puts us in conflict with the decree of human government. But then as the people of God, we are to take the consequences of disobeying human government, again, as a testimony to our God. I think another thing we can learn from this is this. Sometimes when God's servants are put into a tight spot in circumstances, God sees fit in his sovereignty to deliver those servants from harm, as he did in this instance. But we also have to learn the opposite side of the coin. Sometimes God does not see fit to deliver his servants from harm. We have just witnessed an example of that within the last 2 weeks, as one of God's choice servants, Chet Bitterman, was executed in the land of Colombia. There's an instance where God, for some reason we don't understand right now, in his sovereignty, saw fit not to intervene and deliver his servant. Either way, God is still sovereign. Either way, he's got his purposes. And either way it is, we as God's people must throw ourselves upon the grace of God to enable us to obey him no matter what the consequences, and then take the consequences as children of God for his honor and for his glory. Let's pray.
A free catalog listing other titles in our cassette library will be sent to you upon request. Simply address your request to the Friends of Israel, Post Office Box 123, West Collingswood, New Jersey, 08107.